Malt barley has been our mainstay since the 1970s when we first started growing barley. Barley was a nice fit. It picked up the difference there in the early 70s when the brewing company started coming in, recognizing the value of the barley that we could produce for them here on an irrigated bench.
Welcome to this deep dive episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere. I'm one of your co-hosts for this farmer and rancher-driven podcast, Sarah McNaughton Peterson, and I'm here with Kurt Arnes.
Yes, we're powered by John Deere, so for all of your equipment and technology needs, see your local Deere dealer. So Sarah, our topic today is something that you and I have talked about for a couple of years, I think almost, when we first were starting to think about a podcast. And it's, you know, it's something one of our favorite topics, or at least one of mine. And we're going to talk a little bit about where your beer comes from, right?
Absolutely. And of course, like, we rodeo, and like most people in agriculture, maybe it's just a northern thing. You know, we've discussed this too. I love a good beer. And Kurt, I know we've had at least a few beers together during Husker Harvest Days and at some of our other events. We've gotten to tour breweries. But what is one of your favorite beers?
Yeah, one of my favorites is actually a craft beer from Ben's over in Yankton, and it's Kenny Pepper. So it's got a little bit of pepper in it, a taste, and it is fantastic. That's one of my favorites. I mean, there's a lot of others, but, you know, we've only got so much time to talk.
Right. I don't know. I don't really discriminate between the light beers that we enjoy usually all summer long. You know, if it's a Mick Ultra, a Miller Lite, Coors Light, Keystone, even Grain Belt. But best of all, I do love a good hazy IPA. And especially from one of those nice craft breweries, which we seem to have a lot of here in North Dakota, are those small craft breweries, and they come up with some good beers.
Yeah, and you know, the craft brewery industry is still growing. I mean, it's something that kind of was gone, and then the wineries came back, and now the craft breweries are coming back, and all across the country, it's kind of a great movement. And you know, we talk about the beer, but we don't really talk about where the ingredients come from. And, you know, hops, barley, rice, major farm crops that are ingredients in beer. And, you know, our states, we don't grow rice here, but we do grow a little barley and hops. North Dakota's huge on the barley side. So, you know, we're going to pay a little attention today to one of the major ingredients to beer.
Absolutely. You know, I think our guest today has some insights and a few favorite beers up his sleeve. And of course, no barley, no beer. Mitch Conan's joined us today, and he farms in Fairfield, Montana, and he currently serves as the vice president of the National Barley Growers Association.
Yeah, Mitch certainly does have the background. He is himself a Mart barley grower, and he's on the board of the Montana Grain Growers Association, has lots of experience to share with us. And by the way, Mitch lives in Fairfield, Montana. That is kind of the epicenter for malting barley growing.
So, Mitch, thank you so much for joining us. And tell us a little bit kind of about your farm history and your family, just a little bit about your background.
So, my name is Mitch Conan, and I'm currently vice president of the National Barley Growers Association. And I've been farming here in Fairfield, which is in north central Montana. I'm about 35 miles northwest of Great Falls, Montana, which is about in the center of the state. So I'm about 40 miles straight west of the Rocky Mountains. That's my backdrop every day when I'm riding around in the tractors. I can see the Rocky Mountains from Glacier Park just about to Yellowstone if I really, on a good day. So I got some pretty good views there. Well, our family started here, we homesteaded here back in the early 20s, 1920s, when they opened up this ground. I actually live on what is known as a federal irrigation project. It was built up as a federal irrigation project through the Department of Interior and Bureau of Reclamation. We have a dam and a reservoir up in the mountains. It's right at the face of the mountains. And then we have a couple different re-regulation dams further down. So everything's gravity flow through canals and systems like that. I know my grandpa, when he started farming here, when they opened up this country, they were doing a lot of peas and a lot of potatoes. Since then, it's all gone to wheat, and then it's mostly barley in this country, being as we're irrigated. My dad actually started farming with his brother back in, it had to be about 1965, 66. He came back from working at as a manager of local farm shops, farm stores and whatnot. And I'm actually living in the house that I grew up in right here. So, and on the same farm. had four brothers and sisters, and they've all gone their own ways, and I was the only one that stuck around. I do have a brother that is close by. He's an accountant, but he ran the cow operation when we both became of age and decided what we wanted to do. I'm deathly allergic to cows, so he took the cows, and I kept the farm. Me and the wife have three kids. So we're just carrying on a legacy. My cousin actually lives on the homestead down the road about 5 miles. That's about it. Man, malt barley has been our mainstay since the 1970s when we first started growing barley. Otherwise, it was a lot of hay before that because there was a lot of dairies around. And that was our wintertime job, was hauling hay to dairies. And as the dairies slowly disappeared, slowly all the acreage of alfalfa and everything disappeared as well. So barley was a nice fit. It picked up the difference there in the early 70s when the brewing company started coming in, recognizing the value of the barley that we could produce for them here on an irrigated bench. We're at about 4,000 feet right here. So that high elevation leaves us for cool nights, semi-cool days, as long as we don't get a big heat wave and long cold winters.
Well, Mitch, it sounds like you are farming in one of the most beautiful parts of our country, you know, just explaining where you're at and the altitude and all the scenery you have out your back door. And you and I have something in common, and I also live and work from the same house where I grew up, so on the farm. So very, very fortunate. That's really a blessing in a lot of ways. I did look up, you know, since you're kind of in the heart of malting barley country, from what I understand, I looked up our Nebraska statistics. So we do have 140 acres, Sarah, of malting barley in Nebraska. This is going back to 2018 from 9 farmers. So it's nothing like you have in Montana or even North Dakota, but we used to be a big barley state and really a small grain state, you know, but there still are a few malting barley acres around in Nebraska. So what, you know, the focus, our angle here with malting barley is to talk a little bit about beer too, because a lot of us really like beer. So do you have a favorite, like maybe a favorite place to go get a beer, or a favorite beer that you like, maybe that is made from some of the barley that you grow?
Well, growing up, I think I probably drank just about every beer there is out there. We didn't have much else to do in Montana, it seems. But yeah, my favorite beer is still, I like Budweiser, the king of beers. I've always liked Budweiser. Coors was big back a while back, and they still are again. And we have a pretty good presence of both of those companies locally here. And I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., so my favorite beer in Washington, D.C. is Kilkenny at the Dubliner. So them are my favorite beers. So, but we grew up on all of them, Lucky Lager, Olympia, and a lot of different beers that were the old legacy type beers and that we grew up with. But King of Beers, Budweiser is still my favorite.
I know it must just be a northern thing if you don't have too terribly much to do. So, of course, you drink a beer, because as Kurt and I always talk about, we team rope, we rodeo, and there's always some type of beer around, whether it's Coors, a Busch Light, Bud Light, Budweiser, anything. Anything kind of goes, like you say. But you made a great tie-in right there for our next question. We talk about being in D.C., because our next question for you is to talk a little bit about what the barley industry's priorities are kind of for the policy this year. And I know, of course, we visited on this podcast before about how we still don't have a farm bill. What are some of those policy priorities for you guys?
Yeah, our biggest policies that we discuss when we go back there is that farm safety net. It all ties back to that farm safety net. When we're price takers, so our markets get manipulated by trade negotiations. They get manipulated by just things that are out of our control. So as price takers, we have to really watch that market, but we have to watch our business as a whole. And it's that farm safety net that really gives us some stable ground to work with, and especially with our lenders. I mean, our bankers and our lenders, they really ask a lot out of us to make sure that we can turn a profit on it. And with the environmental conditions, you know, we either get hailstorms or late rains at about harvest time. That ruins a barley crop real fast for us. But even for the wheat or any of the other products, it's still that farm safety net. So having a strong farm bill that has, you know, reference prices that reflect what the local economy is doing. Even regionally, we'd like to see reference prices, because these programs are like a one size fits all, and that's really hard to do when you're looking at wheat in Kansas or wheat in North Dakota, wheat in Montana. It's kind of tough to write national farm policy when everything is so regionalized. But, you know, we'd like to have stronger reference prices that reflect current economic conditions, loan rates that are also elevated a little bit along with the current economic times. You know, that program gets used very, very little anymore because the loan rates are so low. Otherwise, we have to rely on our bankers, and it's getting really, really hard. This year's getting to be really, really hard. I'm in the process of renewing my operation loan right now, and it's getting tough with the programs that we're seeing. So a lot of it is that farm bill, having that safety net, you know, which has basically a 15 to 25% deductible. So, you know, even we're not asking to be made whole every year, because we know there's other issues and we got to look out for everybody else as well. But when you got a program that's got a 15 to 25% deductible, so you're working on 75 to 85% of income that you have to cover a whole year's worth of expenses with, it makes it tough. That crop insurance is the big thing. And we do have skin in the game because we're paying the premiums, a portion of about a third of those premiums. And yeah, we are subsidized to 2/3, but that guarantees this nation a safe and reliable food supply, is basically what that program is for. And if we don't have it, and we don't have a strong farm bill, there could be a shortage in food in this country that could happen really fast, because the way the markets are and the way the current economic situations are with the high prices, we could lose a lot of farms really fast. So the farm bill is just protecting that food supply for our country.
And there's so much uncertainty, you know, in farming in general, because we're, you know, kind of hanging out there with the weather, hanging out there with a lot of diseases and insect issues that can come up, trade and all these other things. And so, yeah, that crop insurance title and, you know, the farm safety net over the years has been really saved a lot of farmers when we had severe drought or we had a whole bunch of problems. And so, you know, what I'm hearing you say is that it's just as important for, you know, barley growers as it is for every other farmer. And you know, that needs to be a big part of, you know, our next farm bill as it has in the past. You are kind of ground zero in barley production, malting barley production in the country. So where is most of the U.S. barley grown these days? And then, you know, as a percentage, how much of that is malting barley?
So as far as the United States goes, most of the barley is grown in North Dakota, Montana, and Idaho. A little bit down in Wyoming and a little bit in Colorado. Montana has, depends on how you want to scale it, Montana has the most acres. Idaho grows the most bushels. So we're always at a 1-2, in that 1-2 position there. But yeah, Montana, I mean, North Dakota used to rank pretty good along with Montana for years, but corn and soybeans have moved into that state and eaten up a lot of those acres. Montana usually has the number one in acres. And I was trying to look here. I think if I remember right, there's about 900,000 acres was in Montana in 2023, which is down. I mean, we've usually up a little over 1 million acres in Montana. You know, we average about 51 bushels an acre. Idaho is usually, I don't remember their numbers, but they're not quite as many acres, but they grow a lot more bushels because they have more irrigated acres than we do when it comes to it. So Montana relies on a lot of dry land barley. Then it's up to environmental conditions, whether they make the quality specs that are demanded for good malt barley. As a whole, for the United States, you know, we grow about 144 million bushels. Well, that's what we grew last year, and now it's down 23% from the year before. Usually we've had, you know, 186 million bushels annually over the years, and you know, that's it. Usually about 2.3 million acres total across the United States, which are both down. That's 24 numbers. Them are down from 23 numbers. So we've seen about a 20% reduction in acres from 23 to 24. And that's about it. You know, we're, I think, number 7 globally. United States is number 7 in production. Europe grows a lot of barley. A lot of other countries, you know, over in Eurasia area and whatnot, they grow a lot of barley over there. But most of it is for feed. I know in the United States, the barley that's grown in the United States, about 3/4 of it is used for malt purposes. Otherwise, the other quarter is for feed. And a lot of it's going into pet food industry anymore. It's the alternative to corn and sorghum when it comes to feed.
I know it's, especially in North Dakota, you're talking about the decreases. And I know NDSU published some stats that in 2024, North Dakota grew about 370,000 acres in North Dakota, which is down over 50% from 2023. And so I think it's really interesting kind of to see like how those other crops move in and what those changes kind of look like. But one thing I want to talk to you, since it seems like we have so much barley production in the United States, with so much malting barley, how do some of the growers access the malting barley market and kind of find contracts for their crop?
Well, it's, you know, a lot of the malting companies come to us or make available to us the contracts. And, you know, it's whether it's dry land or irrigated. And then depends on where they have storage facilities or where they have processing facilities, how close them are. I know Idaho Falls has quite a bit of malting plants there and a lot of storage down there as well. So that's why Idaho is big. Southern part of Idaho in the irrigated plains down there are big in malt barley production. Same thing here in where I live. I have Anheuser-Busch has a storage facility in Fairfield, which is about 5 miles away from my house. They got about a 3.5 or bigger, more million bushels worth of storage there. Coors just put in a plant here about 10 years ago. They're about 10 miles east of me, and they're right on I-15. So, and then they just ship from there. So, I mean, it's worked good that way. And it's been over the years that they come in, they know that this irrigated ground grows good barley. The dry land can grow good barley if we have good rains and timely rains. One year they can make it, the next year they can't. And the big problem there is if they can't make the quality specs, there's very few places for it to go other than the feed market. We are kind of blessed here. I am kind of blessed here. Malt Europe actually has a malt facility in Great Falls, Montana, and they run about 16 million bushels a year through that plant. And while they're malting all of the good malt barley, a lot of it, pretty good share of it from around here and elsewhere. But if it's off spec, if it's high protein, they've also got a market for that because it goes to the distillers. It's not just for beer. It also goes to spirits. So I'm kind of blessed to have that competition, three different competitions right here close by. And they come out and they offer us contracts. They come out with a price point that they have. And they usually have some pricing schemes, usually three different options that you can take. You know, you can work a basis contract or production contract, or you can just take their board price. And it's something that everybody can figure out how they want to do their own marketing type plan. So it works pretty good for us. So
you talked a little bit about the different markets for barley and the percentage of that's malting barley. And in the old days when we used to have a lot of hog producers here, you know, everybody had raised some pigs. Barley was grown a lot for sow feed. You know, that was what people grew it for. It was a lot of barley around. And, you know, that's of course changed as the conditions have changed in the economy and the little hog farms have gone away. But what are some of the major challenges agronomically with growing barley these days? What are some of the disease issues, insects that kind of cause some problems? How is those types of conditions being handled these days?
Well, you know, and a lot of that comes out of the research from our universities, which is another purview of our our organization is maintaining those research dollars for abiotic problems, you know, or whether it's bugs or diseases and stuff like that. So we rely on the universities a lot to help us maintain that battle with them. You know, different areas, you know, like I was mentioning before, you know, we're different areas have different grow patterns. That's why you have southern Idaho and you have Colorado and Wyoming and then Montana. We all have different climates. So we're hoping that, or they're hoping, and we hope that that supply is maintained, you know, in case one area has a washout come harvest time. And, you know, probably the biggest things, Montana, we're pretty blessed up here because with the higher elevation and we have a drier climate, we don't have a lot of disease pressure up here. We do have a little bit. The insects are starting to come in. Wheat stem sawfly is big for wheat in this country, hard on the wheat. But they do like barley. I mean, we were told a long time ago they didn't like barley plants, but I'll guarantee you they like barley just about as much. The problem is that barley is usually a thicker crop when it's irrigated, and it doesn't fall down like wheat does in dry land conditions. So I've seen just as many wheat stem sawflies in a barley crop as wheat crops. So it hurts us there too. So it's, I mean, there's all kinds of different bugs and everything else that at different times the Russian wheat aphid hit us years and years ago, and we haven't seen them since. We don't know how, you know, just Mother Nature came in and spanked us one year and said, we don't like this. You guys are growing too much barley, I guess. And then the next year they were gone. We haven't seen them since. So, but I think a lot of that came from the breeding programs too, out of the universities. You know, it's all regionalized. Everybody has their own little problems. You know, Idaho they're prone to late fall rains. That doesn't help anything. And we are maybe 2 out of 10 years, we'll get years like that where we get rains on our right at harvest time and we ended up with sprouted barley, you know. And we're not quite like North Dakota, especially if you get over to eastern North Dakota, Minnesota, them guys over there, they have a lot of issues with whether it's vomitoxin or Dawn, I guess that's the same thing. They have a lot of issues like that. We're Idaho, Montana, we're Wyoming, we don't have those issues because we have a little drier climate.
I know it's always nice to hear about the university efforts and helping out, because Kurt and I both used to have careers in Extension and County Extension, so we always love to support Extension, shout them out whenever we can, because they do just such great work. But changing the tables a little bit here from some of these questions, tell us a little bit about how barley is actually turned into beer, and then a little bit about the No Barley, No Beer campaign.
So beer is, you know, barley is turned into the beer making process and the distillers as far as that goes. I mean, there's just about as much goes into distillers as beer making. So first they'll take that barley and they'll soak it for 3-4 days. A lot of these barleys are bred to where they're what we call hot barley. They will sprout in 3 days if they're wet. So if we have 3 days of rain or fog, heavy fogs, it'll sprout right out there in a field. We don't like that. We wish we had some dormancy back in it, but the brewers and the maltsters, they like that because they can germinate. So what they do is they soak that barley and it germinates. And as soon as that acrospire or that root gets to be about the same length as the kernel itself, then they will dry it down. They will stop that growth process and they will dry it down. And, once it gets down to that dried out, once they get it dried out, then they'll knock those rootlets off. And then they got what they call clean malt and malted barley. What that's doing is it's breaking down the carbohydrates and turning them into starches. And then from there, then they will rehydrate it when it gets to the beer making process. They'll rehydrate it and start adding their enzymes and whatnot that break them starches down into sugars. And then the sugars are fermented in that brewing process. When they add some different strains of yeast, then it starts fermenting, and it's using the sugars from that barley malt as a food source for the for that. And so after that, you know, that fermentation is anywhere from 2 to 10 days. It just depends on the flavors that they want to get and stuff like that. And then and they're usually doing that at, you know, 40 to 70 degrees. It all depends on, they all got their own formulas, how much barley they use, how much yeast they're using, you know, what the temperatures are and everything else. And it's just basically using the sugars from them starches from that barley seed to create that fermentation process. They'll mix it with hops, or they'll mix it with some citrus or some fruits or something else, but it's mostly the hops. And then once they get it fermented down to where they like their little recipe to go, then they filter it down and spin out the yeast. And then they pasteurize it and put it in a bottle and call it beer. So
I know it's such an interesting process. Kurt and I, when we were down in Dallas for a meeting, got to tour like the background of this brewery that we went to. And it was so cool to see like the process and all the different tanks and the steps they go through and the testing processes. And then even though they like were running stuff through the canning machines, like I think it's such a cool process. And it always makes me realize just how much goes into like that hazy IPA that I've ordered. And it's always fun, of course, when it's like the Northern Plains crop you get to enjoy for the most part.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other thing with barley malt. So if you look at a lot of your candy bars or your potato chips or a lot of other foodstuffs, it's got a malt barley extract in it. That's the sugars. That's where it comes from, is from that barley malt. So it's not just beer. It's not just whiskey, scotch, or whatever. It's also candy bars, confections, confectionaries, or whatever you want to call them, and a lot of different foods. They get that barley extract malt as a sugar, goes into a lot of foodstuffs. So barley is a high beta-glucan crop, so which is supposed to be heart healthy. It's just one of the products and it's one of the ingredients in a lot of different products.
Is there a difference when you go to harvest time between harvesting barley, just regular barley that's going to go into the feed supply, you know, probably, and malting barley? I mean, you know, there's got to, as far as quality controls and, you know, settings on the combine and that kind of thing. What, you know, how does harvest work?
No, it's basically the same. A lot of our barley, we grow for malt. Everybody grows it for malt because that's the highest price getter out there. And the only time it really goes to feed is if it doesn't make grade. The barley spec from the maltsters or brewing companies. But it's the same. It works the same. We use the same combines. Years ago, we used to swath it so that we could get it to ripen evenly, and then picked it up. But then it got to the point where, you know, if you get a rain on it and it's in a windrow, it's basically gone. It sprouts way too easy that way. So a lot of us have gone to direct cut, and that's helped out a lot on it because of these hot barleys. That's what I mentioned before, was the hot barleys. If it's laying in a windrow and you get 3 days of fog, not necessarily rain, but just a heavy dew, it will start sprouting. So that's why we leave it standing, so it stays dry. But no, it cuts the same as anything else. We store it the same. We make sure we have aeration on all of our bins up here. We have aeration. We don't run dryers in Montana. Very few dryers like you see back east, because we already have dry air. You know, always low humidities in our area here. And just pulling air through the bins, we pull that harvest heat out of it and then turn them off, and then we'll turn the fans back on when we get a cold snap coming through, and we'll get her down to almost freezing, and it'll store for years in the grain bins that way. But as far as the harvest and everything else going, settings on a combine, it's basically the same as any other crop. We cut it and harvest it the same, handle it the same. There's nothing special to it.
Nothing like the cold snaps up in the northern plains to keep crops good, right? Especially if they're dry enough. Well, that is like such great insight, and thank you again for joining us. Is there any other final thoughts on no barley, no beer, the barley industry as a whole, or anything you want to share with our listeners?
Oh, yeah, and I forgot to answer your question on the no barley, no beer was, you know, that came from the AMBA, American Malting Barley Association. National Barley Growers and AMBA, we joined forces. We have a lot of meetings together and everything else. That basically came from them, and we get to use it in the barley industry at National Barley as our motto or our logo or however you want to call it. And it's a pretty good descriptor out there when you're walking around with a no barley, no beer hat, and everybody wants one, and they're hard to come by. But that's a collaboration between AMBA, which oversees all of the different barley varieties for malting and brewing and stuff like that. And then National Barley Growers, which is the advocating arm of the industry back in DC.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again, Mitch. This is a great conversation. I remember back when I worked in ag media on the radio in 2018, somebody from North Dakota Grain Growers had given all of us like the no barley, no beer sunglasses. And I still like kicked myself for getting rid of those or leaving them in my old office when I left, because I'm like, oh, those are the things I wish I would have hung on to as I'm doing my deep cleaning and getting rid of stuff.
I can get you some more.
I'll email you my address so you can send me that stuff, right?
Sure. That's a good sticker. We got them on a lot of people's computers and their laptops. So when they open it up, everybody can see it's no barley, no beer at the meetings. Everybody focuses on that.
Right. I mean, how many times do you go to an ag meeting, whether it's like a trade show, a conference or anything in ag, and there's not like a beer tent or a beer booth or a company that's doing a beer tasting? I know I was at the Prairie Grains conference up in Grand Forks, and they were giving out tickets for everybody to like go get their beer after from Anheuser-Busch. And it's like, this is such a northern, I don't know if maybe it's not a northern thing, but I know, Kurt, whenever I go anywhere else, it seems like it's especially in the north. We've got the focus on the beers.
You need to come to Montana Grain Growers Association annual convention and first week of December, usually. That was usually Anheuser-Busch sponsors one beer night and Coors sponsors the next beer night. So it's free beers for about a half hour, 45 minutes, depending on how fast it goes.
It gets cut off after a certain time, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll make the trip out west. You know, Kurt, we're not too far from Montana.
Yeah. So I am the past president of Montana Grain Growers Association. Worked my way, was on the board, went through the chairs, and was also a member of NOG at one time. When I was on the executive team at Montana, and then I was also on the board at National Barley. So come June, I will be the president, I'm hoping. So I don't have any opponents right now. The barley industry as a whole, and it's the malt side of it, but that U.S. barley crop averages about $1.07 billion a year. And this is 1922 or 2022 numbers. You multiply that times 400 times for the value added of that barley crop. And the brewing industry creates about $409 billion a year in, you know, beer sales or whatever. So about 68% of the barley goes into beer. 21% goes into feed. 4.5% is going into food, 3% is going into whiskey, and just short of 3% is going right back into seed. But, you know, and that's supporting over 9,000 breweries, over 120 malt plants in the United States, and over 1,000 distillers. So it's a pretty big economic impact when you look at it as a nation. There's plenty of value there.
You know, Mitch, we had just talked about the Super Bowl not that long ago on our podcast, and how important beer is to the Super Bowl, you know, to celebrating Super Bowl Sunday. So, you know, hey, this just ties right into our, we must have a theme, Sarah, on some of our podcasts that we're kind of all leading together, I think.
I think food is just the theme, it seems like. I don't know if we're just always hungry, Kurt, or what, but we're always talking about food or beers or cows or horses or something like that. So it must just be the theme.
Well, that's what agriculture is about, right? That's feeding the country. And as long as we got food, we got security. And we provide that food for all walks of life and for everybody. It's made available for everybody. So, and that's what we're here for as farmers.
Yep. And, you know, Mitch, thanks for your time today.
So, Kurt, we're going to pivot just a little bit here from our conversation, but we have another guest joining us who many are familiar with, especially if they're a big fan of Farm Progress. Willie Voigt has been a mainstay in the ag media world and, of course, is a big part of our team here at Farm Progress before he quote-unquote retired. But he didn't stay away too long for all things ag media. And, Willie, we've got some exciting things to talk about. But first off, we have to ask you, after no barley, no beer conversation, tell us a little bit about your favorite beer, maybe your favorite brewery, too.
Well, that's complicated for me because, of course, I live in Minneapolis, where the rise of the microbrewery has become such a big deal. But my taste for lots of different kinds of beers actually came from a trip to Munich many, many years ago. And I got hooked on a beer called Hefeweizen, which is a wheat beer. Some people don't like it. There's a little banana clove going on. But it is a beer that is quite often made by microbrewers around the country seasonally. It's a spring beer. So it doesn't have a lot of hop. It relies a lot on the barley, which is a key part of Hefeweizen, and it's a wheat beer. So it's the wheat base, and then the barley's in there for the malting flavor. But as we all know, we all love our barley. And so that's important because that's true. No barley, no beer. But yeah, Hefeweizen's big. And then also IPAs, of course, because everybody likes that IPA. Although I'm more on the friend where it starts a little hard, but it ends citrusy. So that's usually your New England hazy IPAs, which this is not a podcast. My wife will kill me, but she's gotten into hazy IPAs and it's great. She loves them. So that's good too. They're usually about 8% alcohol, which means you get one a night, which is cool. But yeah, we like a lot of different beers. I'll even like a good basic Japanese beer or a Mexican beer. That's a straightforward, maybe a rice or a corn based beer, versus, something fancier. But frankly, I like a good Hefeweizen, and that's probably my favorite.
So speaking of beer, we have to go to Germany, right? So just as you said, I mean, just walk right into our topic today. We wanted to talk first a little bit about Agritechnica, which is one of the, you know, we love our farm shows here at Farm Progress, the Farm Progress Show, Husker Harvest Days, New York Farm Show. But Agritechnica is one of the largest farm shows in the world. Visitors from like 149, 150 countries attending, you know, aside from the show itself, because we could do a whole episode on that alone, could you tell us a little bit about an exciting tour opportunity for farmers that you have?
So this is pretty funny. In December of 23, while I was still stinking at retirement, I spoke to the Illinois Farm Bureau Convention, because I also do public speaking around the country discussing technology and agricultural technology. I haven't let go of that. But I was talking, one of my farmer friends from there said, you know what you should do? You should lead a tour to Agritechnica. So I got in conversation with a company called Ag Tours, or it's Trump Tours. It's Tiffany Trump. It's not related to the Trump organization. Tiffany's been doing tours for 20 years. She and her husband, Ralph Humbert, they do tours with many farm groups, have worked with them and all that. So I got a hold of them. I said, what could we put together for a tour to go to Agritechnica? Well, obviously, as you mentioned, 150 countries. The big deal is it's in 39 massive buildings in Hanover, Germany. It takes a good 2 or 3 days to get through the ones you care about. I mean, I would spend a week there. I've been going since 2013, and I was able to go actually in 2023 because I was still doing some work for Farm Progress. So I was able to cover it for Farm Progress at the time, which was fantastic. But so I recommend this trip because if any farmer likes to go to a farm show, or if any farmer really wants to know what's going on in the global equipment market, this is the place to go. And the unique thing about this, and look, I absolutely love Husker Harvest Days. It's the 100, you know, irrigated farm show, only one in the country, very focused on livestock type equipment, as well as the main players in equipment. Then you have Farm Progress Show, which brings you a lot of great cropping equipment. If you go to Agritechnica, it's got crops, it's got livestock, it's got manure handling, it's got lumber management, it's got all these really bizarre things. So it's kind of fun just to go to see all of that. We're going to do this tour. We leave on November 8th, and we get into Germany on the 9th, and we're going to go to the show for 3 days. Those first 3 days, they're special days, and the third day is International Farmer Day, which would be cool for farmers who come on this or people who are farm adjacent that want to come. Tell all your friends to come. After we leave that, we're going to do a couple of farm tours. Going to go to a farm of the future kind of tour we're looking to. And then we're going to do something a little off the charts. But when I talk to farmers about this, and by the way, many people at Commodity Classic mentioned they knew I was doing this tour. So like, again, tell all your friends. We're going to go to the world's largest auto factory. We're going to go to Volkswagen's Wolfsburg operation, where they build not only cars you might have seen, but Porsches and Audis and that kind of thing. So it's a huge facility. And I mentioned it to somebody and said, oh, you're going to love that tour. And it's great. And we're going to end up, so we're going to start at Hanover, and we're going to end up in Berlin, where we'll go to Brandenburg Gate, Checkpoint Charlie, and that kind of stuff. But Berlin's a beautiful city. So we'll be able to end there, and we'll fly home from there. The trip originates in Atlanta. So you have to get to Atlanta to go join us, and or they can make arrangements with the Trump Tours to go anywhere they want to meet us in Hanover and then come home from Berlin. So it's a good trip. It's a good 10 days. Leave the 8th, get back the 17th. So, you know, when you come home from Europe, you're just getting home that day you left. Versus when you leave the 8th, you get there the 9th. Well, when you come home the 17th, you're home the 17th. And I did actually take my wife in 2013, and she had a good time. So I recommend it, even if you bring your spouse, there'll be enough stuff to do at the show. It's kind of interesting to see just a big show like that, or hang out in Hanover and do some stuff right in the market square where we'll be staying in that area. It's easy to get around Germany. Trains and cabs and everything is fantastic. So yeah, I'm excited about it. And I hope that people listening to this think about it, or if they know someone that's been a kind of a farm show nut like myself, it's good. I found out when I went to Commodity this year, and it was good. I see a lot of our Farm Progress editors at Commodity Classic this recently. The problem I have is I did 2 days of a show, and I've gotten out of shape. So I was ready to go home a little sooner than normal. So I guess you got to realize if you got to keep going to shows to keep in shape for shows. I figured that out. So that's important. Just something to keep in mind when you do a farm shows.
You got to get one of those under the desk treadmills. I know I have one of those with my standing desk, and it's life changing. And I'm sprinting around with like Mindy Ward at Husker Harvest Days, and it's great. But besides all the stuff on the tour, which sounds fantastic, I'm guessing you'll have some time to maybe enjoy some local beer and some of the local touristy things kind of in there in Germany. Because I'm sure maybe not all the farmers who may be going to come on this tour have been to Germany before, right?
I think not everybody has. I think a lot of farmers haven't been to Germany. Many have. This is a pretty focused tour. We're trying to keep it business oriented. Essentially, not too business. The farm visits will be nice. You'll be able to see some farms, which is great because they do farm different than we do here. But the interesting thing about Agritechnica to keep in mind too is Deere actually showed the big combine at Agritechnica before they brought it to the United States, the big X10, that monster, the X9. They showed that in Germany before they brought it here. As a matter of fact, there's a funny story. I was at Agritechnica 1 year, and they showed the Exact Apply nozzle at the show. And we were all excited. I was working with a freelancer at the time. We were all excited to do something. And the PR guy from Deere US, and they're wonderful to work with, and I've worked with them for years, he came to me and says, can you just kind of hold that a little bit? Because they weren't launching that Exact Apply nozzle in the US right away. Now, as we all know, the Exact Apply nozzle has become a big deal, and it's a key part of the See and Spray sprayer and all that kind of stuff. But it's pretty funny. You will see stuff at Agritechnica that you won't see in the United States for maybe another year, which is part, and that's of all manufacturers too, which is kind of fun to get the sneak peeks of stuff. And that's stuff. But the companies are also doing a lot of digital farming, and you'll see how that's going in Europe. They do it differently than we do here, but I think it'll give a lot of perspective on how ag tech can be engaged in local farms. And remember, in Europe, the farms are a lot smaller, and those farmers are all in on digital farming and autonomy. So that's kind of interesting too. So that's fun.
Yeah. So on the tech side, really, that is the cutting edge, you know, that you would have a chance to at least get a glimpse of early on. Willie, we want to include, you know, a link within our podcast copy with this. So where can people sign up and give us just a little bit of the, you know, important contact and registration information?
It's at agtours.com. I believe that's right. Or if you search Trump Tours on Google, you'll get there. And then there are links across the top of the webpage, and there's one that says For Farmers. If you hit the drop down, the Agritechnica tour is right there. And then you can see the entire schedule for that tour, arrivals and departures and all that kind of stuff. So it's AgTours. I believe it's agtours.com. Or you can search Trump Tours and it'll come up. And then you can search under For Farmers and you'll see the tour listed. And if you go to the website for Agritechnica, I believe if you look at American Tours, that tour is also listed on the Agritechnica website. I know when we were talking to the folks from Agritechnica Commodity Classic, it was on the list. I told her to cross out the other ones and just circle ours, but she didn't think that was a good idea. I don't know. Maybe it was a translation issue. I don't know.
So last thing is, when do farmers, if they're interested in joining this fantastic tour, have to sign up by?
Well, we'd like them to really sign up before April 1st and put at least a deposit down. Here's the situation. We have to line up lock-in hotels, and locking hotels around the largest farm show in the world is kind of tricky. That's the biggest thing. So we want to lock that in. The tour details show how many meals are included and all that type of thing. The neat thing about Europe is every hotel has breakfast, which is great because they're better breakfast than you'll get here. Matter of fact, I was talking to the tour guy, Ralph's from Germany, and he says whenever Europeans come to the United States, they're quite disappointed in the rubbery eggs and the waffle you make yourself in the hotels they sometimes end up staying in versus what you get is a German breakfast at every hotel you stay at in Europe. Europe and the European breakfast. So we have meals and fun things. But again, April 1st, because we've got to line up the hotels and we need to obviously book airfares and that gets crowded too. But if we can work that out, at least lock your name in and your deposit in before the 1st. We have a minimum to make this tour happen. And so we like to hit that. Ralph Humbert, who I'm working with, says, I have no problem. We'll hit the minimum, but I'll be promoting this on Twitter and my Facebook account again with links as I have. And if you look for me up on Facebook, Willie Vogt, WILLIEVOGT, you'll find me. Find me on Facebook and some of my posts. And then I'll be posting again and I'll be on Twitter on X. It's Willie. It's WVOGT1701A. So that's WVOGT1701A. And don't ask what the number means. Just Google it.
Perfect. Well, Willie, we did find the website link as we're sitting here, and I'll make sure that's included. And of course, it says what's included in the tour, the price, everything like that. So that'll be linked in the episode description. Otherwise, Kurt, do you got any last minute questions? I mean, I don't think Germany is on our bucket list for this year, but maybe in the future we'll be able to get our way over to Germany.
What? I actually already know who from your team is going. Just saying.
Oh, it's the sneak peeks always, right?
And I don't think it's either one of us, so we would have known already, I believe. All right. Well, great. And thanks, Willie. It's great to hear from you again. And remember, April 1 is that deadline. So if you're interested in this, get on it now. And we sure appreciate having you on, Willie. And please take care and have a great trip to Agritechnica.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your time, guys. And thanks for the good work here at FP Next. And keep pushing the envelope. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. And agriculture is under a lot of interesting things right now. So keep doing the job. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Well, Kurt, I think that about wraps up this deep dive episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere. Thanks so much again for joining us and talking about these great growers we have for the barley industry and some of the policy discussions we had. And we'll have some of those links we talked about today in the episode description.
Yes, and to our listeners, we want to thank you for tuning in to this episode of FP Next, allowing us into your tractor cab, your truck, on your farm, and in your shop, and in your fields. A special thank you goes out to our digital production and marketing team members who put in a lot of work with us. And if you want to be sure not to miss any of our top stories, sign up for your Farm Progress text blasts, which bring the hot stories right to your inbox.
You can sign up for those text alerts by texting FARM, F-A-R-M, to 20505. Be sure to follow Farm Progress on social media to stay up to date with ag news and more, and check out the digital edition of your regional publication at farmprogress.com. Stay tuned for our next episode. We'll be visiting with a Farm Progress colleague who reports from the epicenter of the highly pathogenic avian influenza.
Yes, we're excited to be featuring this colleague, so you won't want to miss this. Plus, you'll get a lot of really good updated information.
Absolutely. We all hate the high egg prices, right? And remember, you can follow along with FP Next by listening and subscribing on your favorite podcast platform or YouTube or Farm Progress Online. And be sure to leave us a review if you enjoy the show.
Sarah always says 5 stars or nothing.
Absolutely. I'm going to go crack a beer now after our conversation. And remember, if it's agriculture, your friends at Farm Progress have you covered. Here's wishing you high yields and good weather. We'll see you next time.